Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Osiris.
Hello, old friends. I'm Brian Brinkman, and you're back again for another very special episode of The Drop. If you listened to our Get Back recap yesterday, you are back here in the right place for part two of mine, Jonathan's, Matt's, and RJ's insights and thoughts on the Get Back documentary, which came out this past week, directed by Peter Jackson, which explores the Beatles' January 1969 recording sessions, which would eventually turn into the Let It Be album, but provided a lot of insights into the dysfunctions within the band, the challenges the band was facing at that point in their career, the looming breakup that would happen about 14 months later, but also the brilliant music that they were still capable of making together as a quartet. In part one, we talked about our overall impressions of the documentary, as well as talked about the first of five themes we covered throughout this series, using the past as a guide in the present. As a quick reminder, we are not covering this chronologically. This is not just focusing on part two of the Get Back documentary. This is going to focus here on a couple additional themes that we are going to be tackling here, the first of which is the creative process that was on display throughout the documentary, as well as the outside influences that were coming into the Beatles' inner circle and were starting to pull apart and test the overall bond of the Beatles at this point in time. So I'm going to throw it now to part two of our conversation about the Get Back documentary. All right, we're back. Some of us arrived on time, 11 a.m. A few others scattered in here, 1:30, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. But we've been working, we've been hanging out, we've been talking. We are here once again. My name is Brian Brinkman. I'm here with Jonathan Hart. Matt Dwyer and RJB to break down the Get Back documentary from Peter Jackson about the Beatles' Let It Be sessions in January of 1969. We're going to pick up basically from where we left off, talking through themes that we took away from this larger documentary and kind of just how we're processing this at this point in time. We're going to jump in with the idea of the creative process and this kind of messy, frustrating, sometimes mundane journey to a breakthrough, something that I think we saw in just full focus throughout this 8-hour documentary, how a song begins, how many dead ends it runs into, and when it actually becomes something that you know of what it is and you've listened to over and over again, and what that process is like. Jonathan, as a songwriter yourself, you and I were talking a bit about this. I want to get your thoughts on what this process looked like, what it was like to see the band take just a simple idea of a song and have it become Let It Be or Get Back or what have you.
Yeah, you know, thank you. A lot of people were amazed to see Get Back take shape, and I was thrilled to see it. It's not one of the greatest Beatles songs, but it's a good song. And that process where, you know, he sits there and it's like, well, we've got time. John's not here yet. Let's do something. Because as we said previously, Paul is just peaking creatively. He's just got it coming out of him. He's willing and able, and he's putting in the work. So he's sitting there just kind of riffing on the bass, and he finds something that sounds good. George even, you know, starts following a little on the guitar. He's like, yeah, that's pretty good. It's good, like, musically. And he's just kind of making sounds. And then a line comes out, and then another line comes out that will never be heard again, maybe. But, you know, it's just that sometimes that's what songwriting is. Sometimes songwriting is, you know, you sit down and you've got a fragment of a line or a thought, and you just, you know, some of it's on paper first before you pick up an instrument. But, like, it seems like magic, even when you're doing it. Like, even when it's very real and happening to you, it can seem like magic. And to watch it from the outside and to have it be something that we've had 50 years to connect to, you know, doubly so. But, yeah, I think it's very real. There's just a lot of work. Some songs come out crafted perfectly, like Robert Hunter, you know, has knocked out multiple amazing songs in a sitting. But a lot of songs, they take work, and it's really cool to see and also to, like, know that even the Beatles had to work on it.
I don't necessarily write songs myself, but I play in a band. I've played in bands for a good part of my life, and I've worked with people writing songs. And the writing is one part, but even if they've got a very fully formed song, the band then has to arrange it, and you have to work on it, and people have to come up with parts usually. I mean, obviously there's, you know, songwriters out there that kind of write everything, craft everything, compose every single part. But by and large, I think for bands coming in, it's like, here's the lyrics, here's the melody, here's the rhythm. Now we have to figure out, like, what's the piano player going to play and how's the drum part go. And the number one thing that I kept thinking throughout this, watching the entire thing, for everybody out there, whether you've played in a band, this might be informative for you, or if you have played in a band, you're going to recognize this. This is exactly what band practice is like. It is exactly what band practice is like. And the thing that I kept laughing about is, like, every kind of, like, bitchy thing that one of these guys does to, like, throw a monkey wrench in the process because they're, like, not happy or whatever, I've done every one of them. Everybody who's played in a band has done every one of them. Somebody says something and you're upset, and suddenly you go to run through the song again, and so you kind of, like, don't really play. You kind of half-ass it because you're upset about what's happening. Or you don't like the song that you're working on, so you just start, like, brashly, like, playing another song, whether it's a cover or something else that you work on, to just, like, get people to do that. You've got, like, the, you know, three quarters of the band is working on something and somebody else wants to do some other idea. So they keep just playing other stuff or making jokes and trying to, you know, pull the train in a different direction. I mean, I've talked to a whole bunch of musicians in the last 3 or 4 days, like everybody's saying the same thing. Like, this is exactly what it is like. And it's cool to see that, as you know, to show people who have not been in that band rehearsal room what it's really like. But also, like you were just saying a second ago, Jonathan, with the songwriting part, it's like very reassuring that, like, up to and including the Beatles, this is what happens when you get people in a room trying to work things out. I mean, like, sometimes I'll be in band practice and I get frustrated about that stuff, and then you see this and it's like, oh yeah, nobody is immune to this, including John Lennon and Paul McCartney. You know what I mean?
I think the worst part, though, is that they didn't have better catering. No knock on Mal Evans for his efforts, but come on.
So much toast.
Yeah, I mean, one of my notes that I had was like, and I haven't been in band practice, so, but one of the notes I made was, after 99 hours of making jokes and fucking around and accomplishing nothing, they finally start playing songs and they immediately sound incredible, which is like an overgeneralization, but I mean, they must have done like, I don't know, 50 takes of I've Got a Feeling. And then when they go through it once, like seriously and for real, it's like awesome. Yeah. It's amazing how long it takes to get to that point, which with all those complications that you mentioned, Matt, it's pretty amazing to watch that whole thing come together, especially given that they want to just play, like, I don't know, half of the takes are just jokes there, but that's obviously getting them closer to the finished product somehow.
Yeah. There's the one cut of Two of Us where John and Paul sing through their teeth. I don't understand the purpose of it other than to basically be like, this is a very earnest song. Let's just try to like inject some humor into this and like just have a little bit of fun here in the moment. But yeah, there's so many moments where like someone would play a riff or would sing like a quick line that you're like, oh my God, that's that song. And then another band member would be like, you got anything more? And they'd be like, I don't know. And then they would just start working on it. And you know, the viewer, well, this is going to become Let It Be, but literally all you have is the piano part that everybody knows and the words Let It Be sung over and over again. That is going to ultimately grow into one of the biggest pop songs of all time. But in the moment, you just have this one idea and you can't see beyond this. And then they start tinkering, and their ability to kind of abandon ideas without emotion and just be like, this isn't working, let's go on to something else. And they just kind of know that process. And, you know, while feelings are hurt, ultimately they all know, okay, this isn't working right now, let's go to the next thing. That's not working either, let's go to the next thing. Like you said, RJ, it's like 100 hours of just tinkering. This doesn't work, this doesn't work, this doesn't work. Let's go back to them and let's try to actually play them straight now. Let's try to build up what we have done. And it's suddenly a fully formed song. And it's just hours of figuring that out.
I mean, we should all be able to relate to that. I mean, here we are. We've been working, recording this podcast for 8 hours already. We're maybe halfway through. Ultimately, there will be a show. No,
have you
but
bought your tickets to Libya yet? I just want to make sure.
No. I thought somebody else is handling the travel, right? Back to something RJ was talking about, you know, like when they're singing through their teeth and stuff. Sometimes you just got to, like, you need to work on the guitar part, but the words inform where you are in the song and stuff. But it's exhausting to do a perfect, sing it perfectly every time. It's where you should throw it out. I think one day John's talking about, well, you know, it was a good take, but I don't think my singing is as good as it was yesterday, you know, and you feel off. And it also, that fun element, John is getting him to sing something straight. Seems like it may have been a job sometimes, because he liked to just put on voices and change the words around and, you know, just kind of joke around, not to an impediment of progress, although I'm sure it did at times. I think it's just to keep himself engaged, and because he likes to have fun. He's a bit of a prankster at times.
I think he also had like pretty serious self-confidence issues, you know? Like,
yeah.
He didn't want to do the serious thing because he was like afraid it wasn't going to be good. Whereas Paul would just like push things forward without really worrying about what other people thought, which I thought was a little bit enlightening in this.
It kind of defines where their careers are going to go as well over the next decade. And it's kind of something I kept thinking about, is like, Paul is going to embrace being the Beatle. Like that is his role in life, and that's what he wants to be known as. And he's also going to release all these monumental albums over the next decade or so, create a huge touring band, whereas Lennon is going to kind of just like fall inward. He's going to make timeless music through the 70s. It's all kind of on his terms, and it's all based around his very specific vision of the world. My impression of Paul has always been that he wants to be the pop star. Like he wants to have that, just be a part of like Paul McCartney, former Beatle, whereas Lennon, I think, just wanted to push that aside as much as possible.
Yeah, but he does finally, you know, embrace that earnest side not too long after. And like Paul is fully prepared to sit at the piano and sing a very serious song. And it takes John just a little bit longer to get himself there. But, you know, should we talk about the injection of other energy into this group? So there's a lot of the dynamic of, you know, well, it's, you know, used to be just the four of us. Then we, you know, start working in the big studios and then, you know, not ever working together anymore. And we don't tour and we don't live together. And so we don't write together. And when they finally find that collective energy together, they also inject new energy with Billy Preston, which, leave aside the brilliant, like, filmmaking, how did they do this? You know, if they just happened to have had a conversation about Billy a week and a half earlier. Oh, and then he lands in London and he stops by while they're working. Like, come on, how brilliant is that? But the energy that he injects in the room, it's, you know, they need another player for some of these songs if they're going to do them all live. And there he is.
I thought you were talking about Yoko.
No, that's a different conversation.
No, we'll get there. We'll get there. Okay.
But Matt, you've played in bands, and I wonder if you guys have experienced that. If you've experienced that in your work with bands, where you know, so and so is going to come jam today. It just changes your dynamic, hopefully to the better. Maybe not always.
Oh, for sure. I mean, somebody else comes in, and that's that, you know, the legendary story was like they were kind of falling apart on the White Album and Clapton came in and played on While My Guitar Gently Weeps, and suddenly everybody's on their best behavior. And I think they were probably aware of that to a certain extent. And that definitely happens. I mean, you want to impress other people that come in and play with you. So you're going to be a little bit more focused. You're going to create space for them. You're going to be open, hopefully, to what they can contribute. But the flip side of that is these sort of non-musical participants. And the easy thing to look at is Yoko. Everybody's kind of talking about that. And like, why is Yoko sitting in the circle and how annoying would that be? I cannot possibly imagine inviting my wife to band practice. And maybe if she was there, like Linda, she would be off in the corner doing her own thing, not trying to disturb anybody. She would not be standing or sitting right next to me reading a newspaper the entire time. But the broader circle there, and I mentioned Linda a second ago, there's a lot of people around. Yeah. And that's a challenge for a band. And I mean, I guess being the Beatles, they were probably used to it by this point. But it's like, you know, yeah, you've got to have Glyn Johns there to engineer the session. And yeah, Mal's going to help you out. But there's like a lot of people hanging out all the time that can potentially be a distraction. And they do a good job of just sort of like letting that happen and not letting it be a distraction, even including Yoko. And there's a amazing moment where Paul McCartney makes like the first ever Yoko Ono joke where like, They ask like Michael Lindsay Hogg and Linda are discussing something, and Linda gives an idea about how they should film the concert, and Paul goes, "Oh, thanks, Yoko." Like they were already aware of it at that point. Well, how like this intrusion
that was after
just, like,
the meeting,
a thing,
right? That didn't go well. Where apparently Yoko spoke for John,
right?
And that was an issue for George. I don't think that was the sole issue from George from my other reading. Have you guys done the other reading? No. And so forth. But there was likely an issue, and I can understand why it would be. It's just particularly those her speaking on John's behalf at the meeting. I think John just doesn't want the confrontations. He and Yoko, I can't speak too much to their relationship really because it's not my place. But they were newly and madly in love. He wanted her there. I would not want my bandmate to have his girlfriend, wife, sitting right beside him while we're trying to work. It would be weird. But also, we've all learned the lessons, right? We're 50 years after the Beatles, so there's not precedent for this stuff either. But I have a lot of respect for Yoko as an artist and as a person and their relationship. I think it's this doesn't necessarily help that the image of Yoko in a lot of people's minds, particularly people who don't know or care for any of her additional work, is what it is. It's real. She was there, so capture it.
I was just going to say, I think it speaks to a lot of what we've been talking about all these massive changes within the band over a very short period in time, relatively speaking. You know, you hear Help, you hear Let It Be. It sounds like a band 20 years apart from itself, but it's 4 or 5 years. And in that, they've all gotten married. I think Paul and Linda were, or at least they were seriously dating at that point in time. But John, and when he meets Yoko, it's a transformative experience for him. It's fine. It's the serious artist in the avant-garde world who takes him seriously and doesn't think of him just as a pop star. And that changed him dramatically. And it was a non-negotiable. Yoko was going to be there. And so that, all of that, like, kind of messes with this vibe of what we were talking about in the last episode of them trying to get back to their origins. There's no way to do it unless the wives get out of the room, unless probably the cameras get out of the room, and it's just the four of them, George Martin, a couple engineers, maybe Mal. I feel like Mal's essential here. He proved his worth throughout this documentary. But, like, you know, it's the four of them in a room, hashing it out, talking it out. But you hear it early on in episode one, where George is just kind of like going off about how great Eric Clapton is and how great improvisational music is. And you kind of hear, you feel like John and Paul just being like, okay, let's stop going on about the Clapton guy. You know, he did a great job on While My Guitar Gently Weeps, but, like, George, have you read? He's an anti-vaxxer, like, all this stuff. No. You know, he...
Well, it's funny, though, and I wrote this down because I thought it was interesting that George is talking about Clapton, and but in the same episode, you know, so within a day or two, they're playing that song Commonwealth with this, you know, lyrics that riff on Enoch Powell, who was a racist, and that's who, you know, Clapton in his infamous rant in 76 was touting the policies of Enoch Powell, which were very discriminatory and negative. Yeah. So
there's something really cool there about the just to kind of wrap up on the wives, like, it's very interesting to me, like, the dynamics between each band member and their wives and the way that they appear throughout, because you have, like, you know, John, his insecurity and needing Yoko to be there as a mother figure because he lost his mom so young, and just, like, needing it like a blanket just to, like, help keep him safe, like, right next to him the full time. George, you know, Patty Boyd, I guess then Patty Harrison, pops in very, very aloof. In the corner, she kind of sneaks over, she whispers something in George's ear, and then she, like, leaves, you know, just wanders out. Ringo eventually, Maureen Starkey, like, just eventually, it's almost like he's like, well, all the other wives are here, I might as well bring Maureen out. And she just sort of, like, is laughing off in the corner, just like Ringo, just sort of having a good time, happy to be a part of the process. But then you have Linda McCartney, who is just like Paul. She's, like, bubbly and warm and wants to be supportive of the creative process and just wants things to move forward. And she backs off when she needs to, but she gives her voice to the process when it's asked of her. Just such a supporting presence. I put in our show notes here, and I know somebody agreed with me because it got highlighted. I just said, Linda McCartney, absolute smoke show. I mean, and I'm not just talking about how gorgeous she is. Her entire presence, her persona, it's like, of course she's the one who got the cute Beatle, because she's just this, like, amazing, effervescent personality, and, like, gives, like, so much love to the process. And I was watching it, I was like, I feel like I've never appreciated Linda McCartney before. I mean, she's such a wonderful presence in the room with the band.
And also an artist working her art at the time, because she's a photographer and she was, you know, she was a well-known pop photographer at the time. before she was known as Paul's wife, she was, and so there she is taking pictures of the Beatles and producing some iconic images, you know, at that time.
There's a moment where I forget what song they were listening to, but the camera zooms in on Paul and Linda just hands clasped, and that Paul and Linda realize it, and Linda kind of gives the camera a look, and Ringo sitting next to them just starts slapping their hands together, and just like is this like throwback to this, these like goofy young dudes who just, you know, would like mess around with each other in front of the camera. But like Paul and Linda were having like a moment in the studio listening to either one of his songs or something that had just been recorded, and they were cutting back at that point.
Well, while we're on our Paul and Linda riff, there's this great moment when he's playing, when Paul's working on the Long and Winding Road, and he's like, yeah, we'll shoot this on a farm in Scotland. And Linda says, oh, I'd like to look at a farm in Scotland. And they do, by the way. When the Beatles break up, he and Linda, you know, married and move to Scotland on a farm. And that's where, you know, I think I'm just... Their whole career was so truncated, but, you know, there's so much in terms of the people around them changed in those, you know, months. Like, so Brian Epstein had just died like less than a year and a half before this. I think Lennon's divorce was finalized like 2 months before this session. So like, this is all like, I mean, those are, you know, they obviously were close with Epstein. I mean, he, you know, I think John was maybe the closest to him, but, you know, they lost like their main kind of... I don't know what he did, but he helped them for so long. And then, like, you know, John's going through this other huge, huge traumatic event, like, just right before this started. It's just, it's wild to think about, because in some ways they just show up and they look like they're just, like, rock stars coming from their mansions to come play music. But there's obviously, like, there's a lot of turmoil happening.
Lives are being led. Yeah, Brian Epstein was, they talk about it in the thing, you know, he was the guy who says, puts on the suits, you know, he was... connected them with opportunities. He directed them when they otherwise may not have been directed. It's just like George Martin as another father figure in their business. You notice George Martin is there, but he's not entirely running the show. You know, they're out of his element, so they're no longer at EMI, but they lean to him when they need technical stuff. They kick around Magic Alex, and he's like, no, let's, you know, we should get something that we know is going to work. In addition to the wives and, you know, the film crew, they have these very important figures around them as well. And they're used to working with some of those people being around, as, you know, Mal and George and technical engineers plugging in things and setting up the mics and stuff. And so Glenn, who is attempting to be a collaborative producer, like the way George was, but I don't think he has the respect of the band the way George Martin does. I don't think he ever got that chance. And the film crew, I think after a while they became just invisible, other than you know, Michael.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk about the Magic Alex? Because like, so he builds this new studio and then they show up and nothing works, and they're like, I guess we better start over quickly.
Right.
I mean, that's insane.
He'd been in their orbit for a couple years, since 67. I don't know exactly when. Somebody else will know that better. We'll leave that to the true Beatles podcasts. But he was, as they say in the thing, he's a guy who would, you know, he was near an idea and then would claim the idea, but he could never actually really successfully make the thing that he said he could do. They gave him a bunch of money when they formed Apple and they got the Savile Row place. They gave him a bunch of money to build a studio, and it didn't work. I mean, the rig didn't work. Mm-hmm. It sounded terrible. And so they, you know, yeah, they had to quickly gut it and call George to call EMI to bring in some stuff so they can actually finish the dang record.
It's wild.
One thing I was thinking, just with regards of like the wives and like these outside influences that are almost pulling the band apart, is India. And there's moments that are referenced throughout this documentary of their time in India, which was, I think, about a year, year and a half prior to this, maybe even less than that. It was sometime in 68. That clearly changed George's life. Like it impacted him from the moment that he was there until the very end. And it's almost like that's like the Yoko for George that's there, because when John and Paul, who kind of look back on the film of that and are like, we just weren't ourselves. Like, who were we when we were there? What were we trying to accomplish? What were we trying to do? And for George, he found answers that would just define him until his death. And there's just moments throughout it where I felt it early on. I think it was when they were first playing Don't Let Me Down. And it's just kind of this blues number. And George just kind of tosses off, I don't really like that. It's just kind of the boring, like the same old stuff, just paraphrasing. And you can kind of hear him musically want to go into a different direction, this more like complicated improvisational direction that will define where he goes with All Things Must Pass. But, you know, as his music goes on, and that to me is like a part of this transformative experience he's just been through, that John and Paul clearly just like, they crack jokes about Hare Krishna's Christmas Club at some point, and like you think like, oh my God, is the band actually going to break up again? I don't know. It's this constant tension that just rises in and out of this documentary that, you know, knowing now, looking back 50 years from then, how this will impact the varying directions each of these guys go in over the next couple of decades. But in the moment, just feels like it's filled with so much tension.
Yeah, I have a couple points on that. Is, you know, first of all, I, Me, Me, Mine is all from the Bhagavad Gita. So, I mean, he is still very deep into this stuff. It's very important and new to him still. And yeah, he gets mad when, like, he plays it sort of cool, but it's very clear that he's just like, he's taken a level of offense when they're saying, oh, we weren't ourselves when we were in India. And he was like, you were supposed to find out who you were. And I, as I said earlier, you know, I think he kind of did. And, you know, he's got the Krishna guys hanging out when they're twicking him. And we get that great callback to Hard Day's Night. Very clean, though, isn't he? I love that. And it's one of my favorite movies of all time. It's like my number one or number two, depending on the day. And so, so great. And then the other thing is, you talk about this, you know, we look about at their career 50 years later and whatnot. There's this bit when, you know, they don't know if George is coming back, and Paul says something to the effect of, you know, at some point we'll all be old and we'll be singing together.
Yeah.
And they never did. Which is
crazy.
Which is sad. I was very sad when I heard him say that.
Crazy.
Just kind of a random thought, as a audio engineering geek, one of my favorite Easter eggs in the entire thing is the fact that working on this and called out with subtitles are Chris Thomas and Alan Parsons. They kind of got their start working on this album. They worked for EMI as very, very junior engineers. Up to this point, they had basically been fetching coffee and ciggies and whatnot. And they got their first real shot to work on something with this project, thanks to Glyn Johns. And then fast forward a few years, working in-house at EMI, these are the two guys who are the technical wizards who create Dark Side of the Moon with Pink Floyd. So it's amazing through line, if you can see. I mean, just 3 years later, they're working on that.
And then Alan Parsons had his own project. I can't remember what that was.
So we got to, on the last episode that we do, we should pick it up with Billy Preston, because it's just, I mean, we haven't really gone into depth about how incredible that whole scene was. Can we do that, Brian?
Yeah, I think that we'll touch on that in the next episode, because all that we've been talking about these outside influences, Jonathan hinted at it earlier, like Billy Preston could have not worked, and it could have been just another one of these episodes of someone who comes in, is not a part of the Beatles, why is this happening? And something about like the way that that dude smiles and moves around when he's playing keyboards, the way that he adds just like the perfect tone to these songs that they're writing, it works perfectly. So we'll jump into that, because that leads to the rooftop as well.
Can I just, Brian, can I just end with my favorite part of what Ringo said, where they're sitting around talking and then someone's like, Ringo, did you enjoy your time in India? And he was like, not really.
Incredible. That's being himself.
All right, so we're going to wrap up this episode. We'll be back tomorrow for one more deep dive breakdown into the Get Back documentary. Thanks to everyone who has been listening. We will see you here, same place, hopefully same time tomorrow.
Osiris.
Hey there, I am Johnny Christ from Avenged Sevenfold, and I've got a podcast called Drinks with Johnny you're going to want to check out. I sit down with a bunch of different people from all different walks of life, from professional wrestlers to actors, comedians, fighters, musicians, everything in between. I'm just looking to make some friends and have a good time doing it. So if that sounds like something you're into, go check out Drinks with Johnny, streaming everywhere now.
Hi, I'm Daniela Clark.
I'm Barbara Ann Wild.
And we are the Honest AF Show.
Our podcast is real, honest conversation with our celebrity friends and pros.
Covering our anything but average rock and roll lifestyles.
All while tackling the hell that is aging and the battle of beauty.
Oh yeah, nothing is off the table.
The Honest AF Show is available wherever you get your podcasts.